Hello and welcome to Deep Impact, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we dive deep into Wildbo's most forgotten work 5 years on. Coming up next is Elliot Diebold.
And that was Ruben Morehouse.
And we are back to talk about Signature 8.3. So let's get into it. So obviously, We don't have a main character. I mean, we don't have a name for our main character right now. So we're going to keep calling her the girl with the checkered scarf for a little bit, I guess. Or maybe we'll figure something out along the way.
Yeah, I got to say, though, I'm really impressed with how Wildbo manages to not really feel that, make it feel forced.
Yeah.
Like, as you're reading...
Much better than us.
yeah, like, sort of reading the chapter, it didn't really feel, like, that obtrusive that she didn't have a name.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, definitely writing this script, I got real sick of typing the girl with the checkered scarf, and I mean, unless things change soon, I imagine Wildbo probably did as well. but it definitely doesn't feel obtrusive in the writing of the chapters.
Yeah. So the girl with the checkered scarf has is, I guess, the chapter starts with her taking full liberties of her newfound ability to swear, and she's basically trying to figure out what Podrick is planning.
Yeah. And I love how the swearing is sort of immediately used to draw us straight back in. Like, obviously, you know, for most people, there's a few days between these chapters. And Maggie not being able to swear was a huge part of her character, really.
Yeah.
And it really reinforces how separate the girl with the checkered scarf is from Maggie right now.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that she can swear is like, actually... terrifying in a way. it really reinforces how bad this is.
Yeah, it really gives you this feeling of, hey, this is wrong, right? It kind of reminds me of, this is a Worm spoiler, I suppose.
Don't swear?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. That moment when there's a character trait that is so clearly defined that even just kind of dropping the hint of it immediately gets you into the exact mindset that Wildbo wants to get you into.
Exactly. Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
Speaking of don't swear, she really takes to the swearing, right? Like she is dropping all the swear words she could think of, basically. And obviously she has a pretty good reason to. But you know, it's interesting. She really flips the other way on it.
I'd have to go back and look at 2.x or no, she was 2.y, and see how much she was swearing back then. I don't think it was something we really took note of, but...
Yeah, true.
I mean, obviously, as you said, this is a situation that kind of justifies some cathartic swearing.
Yeah, and you know, swearing obviously is kind of cathartic because it's taboo and you this is a word that you don't usually say, right? So saying it just kind of releases this endorphin thing. I imagine...
They have done studies, I think, that show that swearing has like a mild anesthetic effect when dealing with pain.
Right. And I imagine that, I mean, obviously I'm no scientist, I'm no brain chemist or whatever, but I imagine it's because of how it is a taboo, right? It is a bit of a, like, you're getting away with it. And I imagine that based on how much of a taboo swearing has been for nameless girl, this would really help her out. I don't know. Maybe she's got access to super pain relief from swearing now.
That's a good point. You know, maybe if you don't get to swear as often, it would have more of an impact. I mean, that makes sense.
Mm. So our point of view here considers the predicament she's in and kind of starts working to track down Podrick, but... realizes that she is being surrounded by goblins who are waiting to pounce on her.
Yeah, so we already touched on this. I hope she gets a new name soon. the POV is a good term for her. I might try and stick with that for this chapter. But
yeah,
I mean, I guess I'll just jump into this now. I don't think she's going to get the name Maggie Holt back.
Mm.
And that's just based on sort of Wildbo, I think... in my experience, doesn't really just sort of have big things like this and then have everything go back to normal, which is sort of what it would feel like her regaining her name is. So I think she's maybe going to have to claim a new name or a new title.
Mm. Do you have any top picks on what she could pick?
One idea I had that I kind of like is like she'll get the ghost of Molly to give her... her name, like she'll become Molly.
She'll become Molly Thorburn or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how that would work.
That's creepy.
But, just because, you know, Ghost Molly is kind of our only friend. It comes up in a very short list of friends that we'll get into later.
Sure. And even, it's so funny to me because it reminds me of, oh, this is a nice on-point reference. You know in The Expanse how, what's-his-face, the detective,
Miller. Kind of,
right, he's thinking about this girl who he's never met, and his whole plot arc is him falling in love with an idealized version of this girl who he's never met, right?
Yeah.
And it's this very human thing of when you haven't seen somebody in a long time or even met them before, you build up a very specific picture of what they're like in your head, which honestly could be completely nothing like what they're actually like. Mm. And that's the relationship. That's the Molly Walker that Maggie has a connection to, right? Is a abstract, completely not her version of it, right? Like the fact that this is her only friend is, I don't know.
I mean, we get confirmation this chapter that the Molly Ghost is mute and you know, it's probably not the strongest echo. I don't know, but yeah, like it's, yeah, you know, she sort of, it's clear from what happened this, or what's said this chapter that the Molly Ghost hasn't been talking back to her. So Maggie was just kind of going there and just chatting to the ghost and it was a very one-way thing. And since it was a bit of a ritual, I think it's something that she will be encouraged or at least think to do again, and that's why I think like the Molly ghost will still be in this arc a bit. And
yeah, okay,
just because Molly and Maggie sounded similar, that was just one of the thoughts I had. And then the more I thought about it, the more I was like, oh, that could be cool.
You know, if Blake ever does come back and finds out that this nameless POV is now called Molly, I think that will be a point of contention. Yes. Like, did you murder my cousin just to steal her name kind of question?
No, that was just a backup.
Yeah. Anyway, so so POV here is surrounded by goblins. And it's funny because I think this is the first time that we've seen goblins, like goblins, not like the hyena who is a goblin in name, right, but, you know, scary.
Yeah.
This is the first time we've seen actual kind of comic relief-y style goblins be a real legit threat. Like, they're still kind of their usual disgusting selves here, but it feels like the stakes are much higher. And it's this weird feeling of like they're the same thing, but actually we're seeing from the other side how scary these things can be.
Hmm. Well, the girl with the checkered scarf's, like, spirit is kind of being drained. Like, she's weak. And you sort of see that. Like, she can't keep the goblins in her sight. Like, they're avoiding her, which...
Yeah.
Like, they weren't able to do to Lola and presumably even Maggie back when that was her name. So, it's... Well,
it reminds you of when she was at her most powerless, right? When she was kind of desperately trying to look at the goblins that messed with her hometown.
Yeah, well, and it reminds me of what they're able to do to unawakened people who have, like, no powers. So it instantly creates this sort of sense that she is really weak and they're a really big threat at the moment.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
So another thing that I wanted to talk about is she brings up her hometown. She calls it her home again.
Mm.
Seems like she has a very strong connection to this place in her head still.
Yeah, she still sees it as her home, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I wonder if that... I don't know. I'm just sort of grasping at straws for what she might be able to do next because I have no idea where you would go from here. But like, that's... I don't know if her hometown is going to be an important factor in deciding who she is going forward.
Yeah, you kind of get the sense that she's... well, not just get the sense, this is in the story, I think, but she's trying to figure out what to do to tether herself down.
Yeah, exactly.
As it were. So, yeah, it's very interesting thinking about Molly and her hometown and what are the things that potentially will be able to tether her to existence so that she doesn't just kind of go to some nameless place.
Yeah, yeah.
So, our POV, our main character here, recognizes Buttsack, who is being his usual gross self, and gives her a letter from Maggie Podrick, depending on how you play it.
I mean, I'm tempted to agree with the girl in the checkered scarf and keep calling him Podrick. I don't think he's entitled to the benefit of having a name that he stole.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
So, I think one little detail I like here is that Buttsack is wearing Maggie's underwear on his head.
Mm.
It's just a nice little, like, whoresome twist.
Mm.
Goblins are always so gross and awful, but these little bits of gross and awful are just kind of funny. Like, it's just so ridiculously unnecessarily awful that it comes back around and is funny.
Yeah. I guess we can talk about this after the letter, after we get into kind of what Podrick is doing here. Because he does give her this letter, which is so, like, you know, the letter is a few pages long and you get to read it, and it's so on point. Let me read out a portion from the letter. Podrick writes, "But wait, leaving the town would mean you weren't around in case the goblins came after your fathers. How tragic a thing is that? It seems you just can't win. I seem to be going on and on. I'm just so very excited. You might even say I'm as giddy as a schoolgirl. Ha ha." So yeah, obviously Podrick is the villain of this little situation, but he's rambling on and he's so like maniacal about this situation. It's very like, I don't know, it's fun in a very terrifying way, which I think applies to a lot of this chapter.
Yeah, I mean, you feel a bit bad for how much you enjoy reading this letter. Like, it's so it's so over the top crazy fun that I was kind of like, oh, this is awesome, but also like, no, don't do this. I mean, that's really the fairy in a nutshell so far. Like, it's kind of like, oh, that's awful, but it's kind of cool.
yeah.
and they're making me feel terrible for thinking that.
I want to kind of touch on what Podrick is playing at here, because he does, you know, one of the things that he goes over in the letter is how he gives Maggie's clothes to the goblins as a way of helping them track her down. And that's obviously a logical reason for it, but it also kind of feels like he's trying to make her feel really shit and violated, she calls out.
Mm. Yeah.
And I wonder, because he also kind of plays at, hey, maybe when I get back into town, we can attempt some kind of reconciliation. And it's very much like, it's hard to tell exactly how bad he thinks he's treating her or how bad he wants to be treating her here.
I don't know. Well, he sort of admits that him promising to come back would just sort of be fake anyway. Like, I felt like that whole section of the letter
very
was him basically... yeah, that whole section of the letter to me was just him sort of rubbing in how in control he was. Like, he's saying, oh, I could even say I'll do this, but, you know, I'd just be able to do this. Like, you know, you can't win is one of the lines, and I think that pretty much sums it up. But yeah, I don't know. It is just the fun ravings of a madman, really.
Yeah, totally.
This whole letter. Like, he hypes up this game that he's created for so long.
The game.
And then, yeah, and it's like, and then he's like, oh, I better tell you the rules to the game. It's just, the goblins are going to try and beat the shit out of you until sunrise.
Yeah.
Like, that's not very
clever.
What
a game. Oh, I love that game. It's my favorite game. Yeah, I mean, like, the charitable reading on that is that he's trying to set up a situation for Maggie to have to use her wit to whatever outsmart the goblins, but it's not a super brilliant game. Like, he's no mastermind here.
No, and I think that's really like indicative of the fairies. You know, I think they walk around acting like they're very clever and they think all their games are super clever, but in the end, a lot of it does just seem to come down to like, and then everybody dies because we killed them or something.
Yeah. Oh, so tricky. Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah. So the game, as it were, the letter outlines that once Maggie stops reading, the goblins have the time from she stops reading until sunrise to break her. And if they break her before sunrise, they win. And that's the game. It's brilliant. It's a masterful game, Patrick. Podrick, good job.
Yeah, he definitely went to uni for game design.
too close to home, Elliot.
So what's interesting to me here is that he's quite specific on the rules of how they have to break her. Like, it's basically a list, and it's like, you know, she can't be allowed to hold a pen, she can't be allowed to walk. To me, it actually showed a bit of insecurity about what would happen if she was still able to do those things. Mm. Like, I don't know, part of me thinks that he knew there was a good chance she'd be able to get out of this, and part of me thinks maybe he actually didn't expect her to, get saved at the 11th hour, basically.
Yeah.
Just the specifics of how much he wanted her dismantled makes me think that he is a bit worried about what she might be capable of if she's still around when he does need to come back.
Do you think it is kind of denying her access to practitioning? Because he says she can't be allowed to walk, which, okay, whatever. Hold pen or parcel, speak or see, which are all kind of the things you would need to be able to do to practice, right? At least as far as I can tell.
Yeah. I do think that's pretty much it, because, you know, it could be, you know, he doesn't want her doing other stuff or whatever, but, like, I think at the end of the day, if she is going to have any ability to do anything to someone like him, it's at least going to involve some sort of practicing, probably.
Mm.
So I agree. I think he is actually trying to have her taken out of the picture.
But then why not just say killed? Why can't? I mean, I guess he wants to give the goblins a chance to have fun, but in a way that can't come back to bite him. I don't know.
Not just the goblins. It's all dramatics and, you know, fairy shenanigans. Yeah, you're
right. It's theatrics, right? Of course. Yeah, it's a real to the pain situation, isn't it? So of course Maggie says, "Oh, from the time I stopped reading, eh?" And just keeps reading. She pulls some real rules lawyering practitioner bullshit, where she says, "I'm still reading. I'm trying to derive the hidden meaning behind these words. I'm going over these passages again." And she threatens that she'll forswear Buttsack if he argues against it, and he's not sure enough that he can stop her to do so, basically. It's a nice little bluff.
Yeah, and it leads us into the most awesome slow speed chase scene of all time. It's not even really a chase scene. It's like the opposite of a chase scene.
Yeah, because the goblins are out in front. It's not a chase scene at all. It's very weird. it's like a malicious, like, Baby's Day Out style movie where things are maneuvering themselves out of Maggie's way or into it instead.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a really fun conceit. So sorry, I shouldn't say Maggie. I should say point of view. Because she's walking and reading, and she obviously has to be safe, she has to continue to focus on the letter and continue to read it. But she also has to walk somewhere. So she's walking without being able to pay attention to where she's going. And the other goblins are basically trying to put obstacles in her way that will either force her to stop walking or stop reading or both. It's very fun. It's like, obviously goblins are good at these weird prank things, and that's being turned up to 11 in this high stakes, like, pranking game where they have to prank Maggie in time to get her to stop walking. It's awesome.
It's like she's trying to be that sort of Looney Tunes character who's walking around reading a newspaper and doesn't notice all the things falling apart around them.
Yeah.
But in this case, she actually does. She's just trying to not. It's pretty great.
It's so good. It's such a fun... Again, it's the stakes obviously feel high and it feels tense, but it is just a fun setup for a chapter.
I also like how it sort of gets rubbed in how dire this situation is, where every time she pulls her focus back to the letter to make sure she is actually reading it so they can't call her out, I'll just read these quotes. She forced herself to return to the reading. Her eyes fell on the line. "It seems you just can't win." And then there's another point later where she goes, "Her eye fell on the line. They do tend to be stupid little creatures, don't they?" Which is just, I think that happens right after they figure out how to get the other goblins and sort of actually win this fight.
Yeah.
And so it's just sort of rubbing in. It's like, oh yeah, they're just stupid little creatures, but they're smart enough to outsmart her at this point. So it's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, she's walking, but she doesn't know where she's going, right? This kind of continues to pay off. Hey, the checkered scarf girl is alone, as we've been seeing this whole arc. She doesn't have a place to walk to, right? She's got ideas, but she doesn't really find a good place where she can go to be safe. So she's just kind of walking and trying to figure it out as she goes.
Yeah, she actually lists off. She's like, "I don't really have any friends." I'll just read the quote. "No friends, not really. The closest thing she had to friends was Blake, who wasn't even here. Pordrig came to mind, which would be a laugh if it wasn't so fucking tragically sad." And then I think she also thinks about Molly, but it's just, yeah, it completely rubs in how alone she is, how much she just got completely played. It's just tragically sad.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, poor thing. So... As she's walking, the goblins figure out a plan, which is that if they find other goblins who aren't participating in the game, in air quotes, and again in air quotes, accidentally lead them to Maggie without making them sign on to the game, these goblins won't be bound by the rules of messing with her while she's reading. So they can basically lure other goblins here to attack her and cause them to break her focus, and then they can attack.
So it's actually a pretty good plan.
Yeah, no, it's a great plan. And the way they kind of stumble their way into it is awesome, right? Maggie's like half reading, or she has to be paying attention to the papers, and they're making this plot, and she's kind of realizing that this plan is just totally going to work on her. It's horrifying and fun.
Yeah, well, she's kind of stuck because she can't even, like, she wouldn't even be able to engage with them because then she's not reading, right? So
yeah,
she just has to stand there or walk there and listen. And she has this, like, general sense of where she's roughly trying to go. She doesn't make that clear in her narration, but there's only so many options. Mm. And she's not even really sure where it is. So she's just kind of vaguely walking in where she thinks a Duchamp house might be, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's rough. Of course, the goblins' plan starts to work. They bring back some other goblins, and our POV realizes that she's got no chance now. So she basically ditches the reading and just starts running, which doesn't really work. The goblins catch her, and she starts getting, I don't know, ripped apart, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, her focus gets kind of warped as she pulls it away from the paper, which reminded me of a lot of what happened to Blake in the police station after he'd bled himself. So again, to me, it just really enforced how weak she is. She's just falling apart at the seams. Yeah, she's kind of spiritual level.
She's not there, right?
Yeah, and so, you know, that's sort of what leads us into this actual scuffle. So we're like, oh, okay, she's like as bad as Blake was in the police station, and now she's got to fight a bunch of goblins who,
yeah,
like. It's funny because I don't get the impression that, like, a scuffle with these guys would have been an issue 24 hours ago for her.
Yeah. She seems pretty outmatched here in a way that she hasn't really seen before, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting because these goblins are so varied, right? Like, Butzak is, like, pretty big. He's kind of chimpish, I think is mentioned. But then there's another goblin that's, like, a tiny little squirrel with a fork that he sticks into Maggie's shoulder, which is adorable, I guess, or disgusting, maybe. Who knows?
I think it's both.
Yeah.
I guess those aren't mutually exclusive, which I would have thought they were.
Yeah. There you go, breaking barriers. Yeah, it's interesting to me just that goblins can be so varied and all just be so gross.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I'm still buying this theory that they're, like, you know, the discarded gross bits of practitioners and stuff. So, I wonder how ones like the hyena form. Like I get little squirrel ones that would grow off a couple of stray pubic hairs or something.
Sure.
Or, like, I guess we can imagine where Buttsack might have come from.
Possibly it's kind of this idea of if you're really bad, you know, the squirrel goblin comes from somebody who's pretty good, a pretty good practitioner, pretty wholesome, but has a little bit of bad in them. And the hyena is a practitioner who's really bad, not very good at all, but exercises their badness and that becomes the hyena. I don't know.
Yeah, it probably depends on both the quantity and the evil quality of the discardings. Yeah,
I suspect that that's a very straightforward version of this, though. Like, nothing in Lobo stories ever works that simply, right?
No, exactly.
Yeah, so POV here is being basically killed. I mean, it's pretty apparent that she's not in any position to fight off these goblins. But
no,
she gets saved. There's a Duchamp ex machina, I suppose. It's Sandra Duchamp who, along with her familiar, basically completely intimidates the goblins into running away.
Yeah, and, you know, woo.
Yeah,
thanks,
go work.
Thanks, Sandra. Good work, Sandra. I like how her familiar jumps on the POV character as going past. It's just like, yep,
kind of like squishes them into the ground a bit.
Yeah, it's just sort of an unnecessary little, like, you're making me do this thing from the familiar, I reckon.
Yeah, a little small rebellion. Yeah, so I think this is an interesting thing to talk about that we'll discuss a bit here. Sandra doesn't ask for anything in return from POV here, right? I'm going to read out a line where Sandra says, "I could ask for concessions," Sandra said. "Blake Thorburn," Maggie jumps in with, "I'll make," and then Sandra goes, "Shh." Sandra cut her off, the sound surprisingly sharp. "I could, but I won't." So obviously it's meant to kind of read like Sandra is being nice here. And she mentions that she's kind of expressing a repressed motherly instinct, I suppose. But yeah, I don't know. I know we had the interlude from Sandra's perspective and she seemed pretty chill, pretty on the level, but I still just feel like there's something going on here, right?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely stands out to you. Like, when she doesn't ask for the concessions, you're immediately like, okay, so what's
the catch?
Why? Yeah. Like, I was having a bit of a think about it. I actually went back and reread, like, a whole chunk of her interlude. to see if that would help, and it kind of did. But I think she was probably mostly being accurate when she said it was the repressed mother instinct. I'm willing to give her the benefit of the doubt and assume it's like a bit that and a bit she just does. Sandra's someone who sort of gave up everything to be a part of her family, and it like at around Maggie's age, and it didn't really work out. And I think maybe she just sort of really empathizes with where Maggie is, or sorry, not Maggie, where this POV where character this
mysterious
is.
Character. Yeah, yeah, no, I think that's fair. Yeah, I think that's a fair read. I think this is kind of how Sandra presents it to Maggie, at least. So, and presumably Sandra believes this herself, right? As far as we can tell.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. It just does seem to, I guess just based on Sandra's interlude, I'm willing to believe that she actually just does feel like this is something she needs to do kind of for a bunch of reasons.
Mm. Yeah. So yeah, Sandra kind of invites our main character here in, and gives her sanctuary in her house and promises her safety and hospitality, and seems to remember who she is and recognize her, obviously without being able to say her name because it's not her name anymore, but recognizes her and asks to hear basically what happened to get her to this point.
Yeah. I love the bit where Sandra's like, oh, you know, I told my nieces you won't respect the road until you have a car accident. It's the same sort of thing in the practice.
Yep.
And,
yeah.
And the POV character and I had the same response, which is just sort of, I think calling this just a little accident is kind of trivializing what's happened, right? Like this is a pretty big fuck up with no real backup. Like I think it's that bit of Duchamp privilege coming through again, where I assume if a Duchamp teenage girl made a similar level of mistake, the rest of the family would band together a bit to bail them out.
Yeah.
Maggie didn't have any network like that.
Yeah. I mean, Maggie accidentally promising whatever not to swear is a mistake on this level, maybe. But
yes, yeah, that's a much better example.
Almost losing your identity and falling through the cracks. I don't know. Like, that's probably a bit much for a car accident. So Sandra also kind of, to touch on what you said before about you not feeling like Wabo will give our POV her name back, I think Sandra kind of settles this a bit here, saying that it when our POV talks about potentially getting the exiled fairies the fairy court to help out with Podrick, Sandra's response is basically a, oh, sweet honey child kind of thing, like, oh, you adorable thing, thinking that that's even a possibility.
Yeah, exactly. It very much seals this. Even if Pordrig, you know, gets called in by the fairy court and, you know, is in trouble and bad stuff happens to him, she should not go near this with a 10-foot pole.
Like, yeah.
It's gone. Like, her going in there to try to get her name back is just going to get her on the radar of the rest of the fairy, which is just such a bad idea. So, yeah, exactly. I think it really sort of establishes this concept of Maggie Holt is something you will not be reclaiming.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the end of this chapter, right? We have our POV in with Sandra, and we're going to see what happens next, I suppose. this is a short chapter to kind of follow up the horror of last chapter, but I think this chapter has a really fun central conceit of this game, in air quotes. it really is just like a fun, it's a fun scene, right? It's a very fun setup for this arc, this chapter. And this chapter is quite fun to me, especially with Podrick's letter. Yeah, it's just a good time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the chapter was all about establishing how weak and in danger our POV character is now that she doesn't have a name.
Yeah.
You know, she's getting attacked by goblins, so it should be trivial. And it kind of has fun with it because it's sort of, compared to like Blake fighting something like it's so low stakes, so there's a bit more room to just kind of have fun with it, even though it's just as dangerous for our POV character as like Blake going up against the hyena.
Yeah,
it's kind of on a global scale so much less low stakes that there's more room to kind of have fun with it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah, for sure. Now that would normally be the end of our episode, but wait, there's more. We're going to be talking about some comments from 5 years ago. Some of them, one of them. So,
well, on that note, why don't you go first then?
Sure. So my comment is by a user called Hi Happen, who left this comment 5 years ago. Talking about a potential other motive for Sandra, which is that, you know, finding somebody so desperately in need and helping them as she did here it seems like a pretty good way to gain some positive karma, which is a potential motive, not maybe an entire motive, but another reason why Sandra might be doing what she's doing here for our POV. Yeah, it just seems like a good way to get some nice, good karma, which was an idea that I really liked and kind of ascribes another bit of additional motivation to Sandra's actions here, which I think helped flesh them out.
Yeah, I agree. That does make sense. I don't know enough about how karma works to be confident either way. Like, I could see it not being a huge karma boon. I could see it being a pretty big one.
Yeah.
I feel like it should be. I don't know. Yeah, but no, I like it. It does make sense, and if that is true, then Sandra's probably aware of it, so I think it makes sense.
Yeah, cool. What's your comment from 5 years ago, Elliot?
So I've cheated. I actually didn't pull a comment from 5 years ago.
He broke the rules of my game.
I pulled a comment from about a day ago, and it was by Monk Moo in our 8.2 discussion thread on Reddit. And so Monk Moo was talking about this theory they've sort of got going on about how Goblin and the fairy sort of represent the id and the superego from Freud's old psychology stuff, which is like not something I'm super familiar with. Right. I had to go and I'm familiar with the concept, but I did have to go and refresh myself on like what each one is. So like the id is all instincts, mostly like around sex and violence, which is what Monk Moo said the goblins sort of represent.
Mm.
And then the superego is sort of meant to be your moral compass. Like it's the angel and devil on your shoulder sort of telling you, oh, is this the right thing to do?
Yeah.
And so that's what Monk Moo said the fairy might be, which is I don't think makes complete sense to me at this point.
Yeah.
But then they also argue that Maggie is the ego, which is the third bit. And that's sort of, Freud described it as like the rider on top of the horse being the id. So, you know, you have all these instincts, like these violent and sexual instincts, and your ego is this rider sort of directing the horse and saying, no, you can't go there. We got to do this.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So I like the idea of the goblins as the id, but I don't know if the fairy fit as the superego, right? Because the fairy are all about trying to, I don't know, seek their own drama and sex and violence, right?
Yeah, like I think that generally is my problem with all these things that sort of put the fairy and the goblin on opposite ends of spectrums, is that I kind of feel like at the end of the day, they're both just completely kind of evil. So I don't really like anything that puts them completely opposites, which this isn't really doing, but the definitely like Butt-Sack's theory that the goblin and the fae sort of practitioners are kind of split in half didn't make sense to me, because the fairy are just as evil. Something I've sort of been thinking about is, if we take this idea that goblins are just discarded practitioner bits, I was wondering if fairy is something similar, like there's something given off by people or practitioners. And then everything about them is kind of deceit and lies, and obviously that's a big thing in Pact, so I almost feel like they're
the deceitful parts of a practitioner that has to be kind of excised in order to not lie.
Yeah, or there's some kind of manifestation of, I mean, obviously not lies, because it seems to be practitioner side, deceit. But just, you know, like they generate glamour. Usually when you're lying about or deceiving people, it's usually like you're trying to present a better face than you actually have, which is like literally the fairy. I don't know. I haven't worked through this enough, but like I'm thinking something along the lines of like in the world of Pact, maybe they represent a manifestation of like deceit.
Yeah, I guess. Interesting. I like it. I'm not sure if it's something that's ever textual, or it's just a kind of nice headcanon-y additional textual thing, right? Super textual kind of deal, but I like it either way.
Yeah, it may not, the story may not really go into it, which is why I'm not putting it down as a prediction or anything, because it doesn't seem like the sort of thing the story will necessarily address, but like that's just sort of where my head's at the moment.
Yeah, cool. Some good comments from new users, new readers and old readers, I suppose.
Great amount of comments over the last 5 years.
These were the only two comments left on this chapter. So That's the end of our show, though. That's the end of Signature 8.3. Don't fear. If you want more discussion about this chapter, there is a place to go, and that place is the discussion thread that will be linked in the comments, the episode description for this here podcast episode. So click that link, come through, and chat to us, chat to everybody who's reading along with us at the same time.
Yeah, but if you're not into more discussions and you just want more audio, then the place to head is doofmedia.com. There's a whole bunch of audio on that website.
May say podcasts are just distilled discussions, Elliot.
Well, yeah, that's fair. But if you're just interested in listening to more discussions, then doofmedia.com's the place to go.
Yes, definitely. There are lots of great discussions on there. I've been listening to the latest Doofcast about The Expanse, which was mentioned right in this here very episode, and that's why it's on my mind. But yeah, a great episode that I'd recommend checking out.
Yeah, and in fact, the rest of... Well, I think Scott is back in the continent now, so...
Oh, wow.
He's...
not this continent, though. A different continent
well, no,
to
no,
us.
No, his native continent.
Ah, yes.
So, you know, he... the rest of the Doof Media shows should be back this week, so there'll be plenty for you to listen to if that's what you're interested in.
Yeah. Speaking of Doof Media shows, the best way to support the Doof Media network is to go to the Patreon, patreon.com/doofmedia. Doof Media is a patron-backed network, which means that we only exist because of your support. So if you want more stuff, support us more by going to the Patreon. Thanks.
Also, I find it hard to believe that you're listening to this and you don't enjoy Wild Bow stories.
Shame on you.
And so that means that you are, you know, morally obligated mm-hmm. by your... Super ego, man, I've already forgotten.
One of them, yeah, who knows? Even Freud didn't have a solid picture on it, I don't think.
Look, you got to go to Patreon or patreon.com/wildbo and donate some money to him as well so he can keep writing better than I am speaking right now.
Yeah. If you want to get the jump on some of the things that we'll be talking about a little bit early, the best way to do that is to follow our Twitter, which is @MediaMTPodcast, where you can hear Elliot take notes of all the things that he probably will talk about in the episode as he does his live reads.
Yeah, and in fact, because we have our first bonus chapter in a while this week.
Oh, they're back, Elliot, these bonus chapters.
It means our timetable for the week is quite condensed, so I will be live reading about the time this chapter comes out, more or less. So if you're listening to this right now, my live read has probably at least started.
Yeah, maybe we can time it up so that we release the episode and you start your live read, 40 minutes later?
My general rule of thumb was I was going to try and do an hour after the episode starts, but something like that, yeah.
Cool. Well, head on over to our Twitter, @MediaMTPodcast right now, and see if we're sticking to our word. Our next episode coming out will be 8.4, which is coming out on Wednesday the 17th, so we will see you all then.
See ya.